Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of IB Green Minds. Joining me today is Lorraine Whitbosh, Professor of Environmental Psychology at the University of Bath. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi there.
So to get started, could you tell our listeners a bit about yourself and your career path up to this point?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a Professor of Environmental Psychology at the University of Bath, as you've just said, and I'm also the Director of the Centre for Climate Change and Social Transformations, or CAST, and that's an ESRC-funded centre where we're looking at the role that people play in mitigating climate change, in tackling climate change. I did actually my first degree in theology and religious studies with French a very long time ago, and then did a master's in science, culture and communication, and then decided that actually it was the kind of way in which people engage with scientific issues and the environment was the direction I wanted to go in. And I pursued a PhD after that in that area and really kind of just increasingly got into psychology. So I don't really have a psychology background originally, but I've kind of moved into that area. I did a postdoc at the University of East Anglia for 4 years, and then worked as a lecturer and senior lecturer at Cardiff University before coming to Bath. I actually did my master's and PhD at Bath many years ago, so it's very nice to be back.
And why did you decide to focus on environmental psychology in particular?
It was actually that I was interested in the way in which people understood the world around them, and particularly the natural world. It was something that during my first degree, actually, in religious studies, I kind of saw this interesting way in which people integrated, say, religious and spiritual beliefs about nature with maybe more scientific understandings of the natural world. And to make sense of the world around us, and that they found a lot of meaning in the natural environment. And I think that was what kind of got me onto this path of more a sort of psychological perspective, but particularly focused on the natural environment. And around that time, climate change was something that was beginning to be recognized as a really big issue. And so I decided I was really interested in why some people might be quite concerned about this very abstract global, you know, perhaps sort of irrelevant seeming issue, but some, you know, many people were not, and how we might actually communicate it better and get people to respond to it. So it seemed like a really big challenge. This is quite a few years ago now, kind of early 2000s. And since that time, obviously, you know, the area has expanded a lot, and it's clearly, you know, the issue that we need to be addressing now. So, so I think it's just grown in terms of its importance, and as has the area of environmental psychology, actually.
And what contribution does environmental psychology make to efforts to improve our relationship with the environment, particularly in terms of climate change?
So environmental psychology basically is the study of individuals and their relationship with the environment around them. And actually that can include the built environment, but the bit of environmental psychology I do is the natural environment. And it's a two-way relationship. We impact on the environment, of course. We emit carbon, we pollute, etc. But also the environment impacts on us. So we can experience climate impacts like floods and heat waves. And so the contribution that psychology, environmental psychology, has to addressing climate change is really understanding, first of all, how people can help mitigate climate change through their own actions and the, you know, as individuals or as groups across a range of contexts. So actually, while we might often think about the things we can do in our sort of private lives at home, we're also kind of people within the workplace, and we're members of communities and families. So we have quite a diverse range of things, actions available to us, and ways in which we can reduce our emissions and shape society more widely. But also we're interested in how people respond to the risks of climate change and the growing impacts. And so psychology has something to tell us about how people respond to those impacts and how we can encourage people to adapt through their own behaviour and influencing others.
So a lot of interesting questions there. I'm wondering, what is the size of the contribution of behaviour change to reaching net zero, because it seems like a lot of the focus is often on technological developments.
Yeah, absolutely. So the UK Committee on Climate Change has estimated it's a bit less than half of what we need to get to net zero has at least some degree of behaviour change. And actually, my view is that that's a relatively narrow definition of behaviour change, because they're looking at consumer behaviour change, like things like buying an electric vehicle or installing a heat pump, or maybe sort of turning down the thermostat in your house. And that those are important things that we can directly do to mitigate climate change. But then there are those other things I sort of mentioned in terms of things we can do in the workplace, conversations we could have more widely. You know, if you happen to be somebody that is a leader of a local council or work for government or something, or maybe run a business, there are behaviours that you can take that might have really quite far-reaching implications to mitigate climate change. So actually, you could say that the percentage is very much higher, but so it is. It's either way, it's a very significant proportion of what we need to get to net zero.
It would be great to talk a bit about the UK Centre for Climate Change and Social Transformations, which you mentioned earlier. So what do you do as director?
Well, my role as director is really just to sort of steer the centre a little bit, and kind of we as a team, we got the funding and we have at least 5 years of funding, potentially up to 15 if we get renewals. And so I work with everybody in the centre basically to undertake the research and think about kind of getting in funding and supporting people to do the work that they do. It's an interdisciplinary centre across the social sciences. So we have sociologists, psychologists, we have geographers, and we have a few engineers and other people as well. So we have quite a broad portfolio, but what brings us together is really trying to understand how people can reduce emissions to tackle climate change. We focus on mobility, diet, heating and cooling, and material consumption, because those are quite high emission activities and they've proven quite difficult to decarbonize historically. And there's a big role that people play in those areas. That's the crucial thing as well. And we have a whole range of activities in the centre. We have a set of activities around visioning. So thinking about what does a net zero sustainable society look like? And crucially, what does it look like to people within society? What do they want from that? What do they want from that future that achieves their goals and resonates with their values, as well as just getting to net zero? So we're interested in how we can improve wellbeing alongside reducing emissions as well. We do a little bit of modelling work to inform some of that as well. And we're sort of tracking perceptions and behaviours over time through some longitudinal surveys and media analysis. We have a section of work which is looking at how transformations have occurred in the past and how they might be happening in other countries at the moment, to try and see how we can learn from that and apply it to the context of the current situation to get to net zero. And then probably the biggest part of our work is about actually testing out new ways of changing behaviour, changing organisations, changing policy to get to net zero. So a big experimenting theme where we're working with private, public and third sector organisations to actually co-design and deliver interventions to reduce emissions. And that's quite an ambitious programme of work, and we're just starting on that bit actually. So we've had some of the other bits kind of feed into the design of those interventions. And really throughout the centre's work, we do a lot of engaging with stakeholders. So we're really closely working with governments and businesses and others to try and ensure that our insights into how to change society, change behaviour, are feeding into people that are making those decisions as well. So so it's quite an exciting time to be working in this space.
So in terms of the research methods, which you mentioned there, I'm wondering if you're surveying people, whether you have any issues with people maybe reporting generously about their concern for the environment or what kind of actions they take and how you take that into account.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we're really aware in our field of the limitations of surveys. We do rely on surveys quite a lot because they're a very easy way of getting a sense of what people think and do, but we know that they tend to over-report green concern and green behaviours, to sort of to make themselves look better, but also people are sometimes don't actually quite remember all of the things they've done, and so they just sort of estimate, and it can be very approximate. So what we try and do is we sort of supplement surveys with other methods. So we can do interviews with people to get a deeper sense of, you know, how they feel and think about the environment and climate change in the context of other things that they might be concerned about. And focus groups similarly get to provide that deeper insight. Deliberative focus groups, so sort of citizens' assemblies are kind of similar, that you can give people some information and then get them to sort of think about it and reflect on it and then sort of come up with some informed attitudes. That's another big part of what we do. But we also, through the experimenting work we do, we try and get objective measures of behaviour as well. So if we're going to be, for example, doing an intervention in people's homes where we're trying to reduce energy consumption, for example, we might take energy meter readings, or we might be kind of, if we're looking at their consumption, we might look at receipts or waste, the amount of waste that they produce, that sort of thing. So those sorts of measures can be quite difficult to get, but where we can, we try and get them to sort of improve the reliability of our behavioural indicators.
And what are the key ways that the government can prompt behavioural change to reduce people's carbon footprints? And I'm wondering what kind of cognitive biases that all people have make this more difficult?
So there are lots of things that the government can do. So I think, you know, historically they might have relied quite a lot on information campaigns to get people to do their bit. And while information does play a role, we do need to tell people about climate change and encourage people to or have the right information to make decisions. We know that information by itself often is not very effective to change behaviour, because there will be lots of reasons why it might just be difficult to do the right thing, even if you want to. So it can be more expensive, more inconvenient, you know, seems like nobody else is doing it. So the sorts of things that government can do to reduce those barriers, remove those barriers, include economic measures. So they can, you know, for example, have a carbon tax, or at least make certain particularly high carbon products more expensive and subsidize low carbon products, for example. They can regulate, of course. This is probably one of the most effective things they can do, is to just say, we're not going to have those polluting products at all on the market. We're only going to have these less polluting ones. They can regulate in terms of reconfiguring cities. So in terms of the urban context, we can encourage people to walk and cycle by having more pedestrianised areas, by maybe having congestion charging, and so that we're actually not just making high carbon behaviours like driving less attractive, but we're also making the low carbon alternative much more attractive. So doing those things together is a really crucial thing to try and change behaviour. And one of the big things that we're interested in as well at the moment is getting the timing right of these interventions, because we know that when you intervene is really important for how effective it is. And if you intervene when habits are disrupted, for example, if you've recently moved house or maybe started a new job, or you've retired or you're in a pandemic, those sorts of times when your habits are, you know, disrupted, you're having to do things differently, you're more open to new ways of doing things. So interventions are more likely to be effective because you don't have kind of habits just getting in the way, which means that people are sort of just not actually thinking about alternative ways of doing things. So so that's one of the things we're really interested in, is the timing of when you intervene. So yeah, so there's a lot that governments can do, but equally that communities and other organisations as well can do to change behaviour.
Yeah, as you say, a pandemic has obviously been very disruptive. So I'm wondering, in addition to that, whether you've gained any other insights into behaviour change and communication of scientific issues during this pandemic that are relevant to climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think obviously the pandemic has been horrific in so many ways, but I suppose the silver lining is that it has reduced emissions and it has shed some light on how we can change behaviour. And so we've been actually surveying the public through this period to see how people's habits and attitudes have changed. And on the attitude side, we were really surprised to see that actually climate change concern has actually gone up during the pandemic relative to before. And in 2019, it was already at a record high. We were already seeing the vast majority of people very concerned about climate change. It's now even higher. And so it does seem like, even though, of course, people are very sort of anxious about the pandemic and its implications for jobs and everything else, concern about climate change has not been dented by that. It's very entrenched and people really do want action on it. And people's behaviour has also changed, of course. The obvious thing is we're travelling a lot less, we're doing a lot of things more virtually. And a lot of people, crucially, are actually enjoying doing many of those things virtually versus physically. So I think many people are keen to stay working from home at least some of the week. And for many people, they want to do other things virtually in the longer term. So like have GP appointments online, for example, and avoid work meetings, so many work meetings physically. So I think it's quite encouraging in some ways that I think it's shedding light on where we might be going to in the longer term in terms of some of these behaviours. We've also seen changes in people's food practices. So people are wasting a lot less food, partly because they don't want to have to go out to the shops so often, and risk kind of catching COVID. But also just in terms of, I think, having a little bit more time to prepare food, and they're sort of planning a bit better. So they're able to kind of use up leftovers and batch prepare meals and things like that. So all of those sorts of things mean that people are having sort of lower carbon food practices in general. So there are quite a few things that we've sort of picked up that people are doing that are really good for the environment. And now we're really interested to see what can we do and what can governments do to embed those behaviours for the longer term. So that's the sort of the big question now, is how can we design interventions that retain some of these good things as far as possible.
You mentioned there a bit about rising concern, a very high concern about climate change. I'm thinking about, perhaps I'm thinking of myself, there can be a gap between being concerned and then taking action. Do you have any insight into how it's possible to bridge that gap between concern and action without either making people even more anxious or instilling a sense of kind of pointlessness because they think that the problem's too large, or equally inspiring some kind of apathy?
No, that's right. I think it is crucial to get communications right around climate change so that we don't, terrify people and then they just switch off and feel, as you say, there's no point in taking action, and maybe just induce some sort of paralyzing anxiety, versus communicating the severity of the issue and the urgency of the issue, but also saying there are things you can do to actually play a part in tackling it, and it's not too late. Because what we know from the broader psychology literature is that if you're trying to communicate a risk, if you just try to scare people, so fear campaigns, you think about sort of health campaigns in the past, where they just kind of provided some sort of terrifying image of what's going to happen if you do this thing, they can quite often backfire because people just switch off and think, well, there's nothing I can do then. Whereas if you pair it up with a message that says, this is what you can do to actually reduce this risk, and it's, there are things you can do to protect yourself, then it's much more effective. So you can use those sort of, let's say, fear-inducing messages if it is paired up with a self-efficacy message, as we call it, something that shows that you can make a difference. So that's the first thing I'd say, is that messaging really has to be showing what people can do and showing that other people are already taking action. So you're part of a larger collective effort to actually make a difference. And other things you can do as well are really to focus on the positives, and irrespective of tackling climate change, which of course is an important thing to do in itself, for many people, the things that motivate them, and this comes back to your point about there being an attitude behaviour gap, the things that really motivate people in their behaviour tend to be much more sort of immediate things, like, what's the most convenient choice? What's the cheapest? Is this going to be something that just makes me feel better? Is this something which will kind of make me fit in with my friends? Is this going to be good for my health, my family's health, etc.? So really sort of immediate concerns that most people would tend to have. So if we can actually communicate the measures to reach net zero in a way that then align with those other goals and values that people have, So health, for example, we can say, actually, did you realise that if you cut down on your red meat consumption, it significantly reduces your risk of heart disease and various cancers, etc. That's probably more likely to persuade people to take action than only talking about the environmental impacts of reducing meat consumption. Similarly, you know, designing measures so that they actually reduce your energy bills as well as getting to net zero, of course, will be more attractive. So it's really about trying to find those co-benefits, as we call them, and communicating those co-benefits to people in a way that really highlights what's in it for them as well as what's in it for the broader society and the environment.
And so in terms of skeptics, do you think we should, I don't want to say forget about the science of climate change, but maybe skip that a bit and focus more on the co-benefits?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, we've done studies trying to communicate climate change to skeptics, and you can't do it, basically. There's this thing called confirmation bias, which is that everybody tries to sort of look at information to pick out bits that reinforce what you already think and strengthen those existing views, and tends to sort of ignore information that challenges it. So people that are strongly concerned about climate change will do the same. They will look for information that reinforces that view. But if you're trying to convince skeptics to take action on climate change, presenting them with information about climate change will not be effective, because they'll simply see that it's, they just think that it's not credible. They just think this is nonsense. It's a hoax, or it's exaggerated, or whatever. Whereas if we talk about, well, why would you want to insulate your house and not even talk about climate change? Just talk about the actions that you want people to take and that might be good for them, and focus on those wider benefits. Then, yeah, several studies now show that you can convince people that are deeply skeptical about climate change to reduce their carbon footprint by just talking about what the wider benefits are and not mentioning climate change.
Do you have to worry about the spread of skepticism, though? Or do you think that comes perhaps at a different point in the cycle? So if you're trying to get people to change their behaviour, is that maybe a bit too late to be worrying about that?
Well, I think you can encourage people to take action whether they believe in climate change or not. So I don't think you necessarily need to worry about persuading people about climate change. However, that said, I do think there is a role for talking about climate change within society, because what we do need to achieve is quite fundamental transformation of society in order to get to net zero. So it's not enough just to have sort of various behind the scenes measures and hope that the public sort of don't really notice, and, you know, they don't need to understand about why we're doing it. Actually, it does need public consent and support for a lot of these very fundamental changes. So actually, where we're talking about, you know, should we change prices of food to make low carbon food cheaper, or should we maybe even ban certain types of food or other products? We do need to have a societal debate about that. And understanding climate change and, you know, why you might want to take those measures is, of course, an important part of that debate. So while on the one hand, I don't think you can persuade people that have just made up their mind that climate change doesn't exist, you can engage with those people on measures to reach net zero in a way that says, well, let's assume that you don't believe that climate change is real. Why else might we take these actions? Do you think that there are health benefits? Do you think there might be benefits to farmers, or other sorts of reasons for taking these measures? And actually, that's exactly what we did do in the Climate Assembly UK, the big citizens assembly on climate change. We had a huge cross-section of the public take part, including climate skeptics, as well as right the way through to people who were very concerned about climate change. And everybody was able to engage with the issue because they could see that the implications of these measures would be implications for them, and that it was important that they had a say in whether we implemented them, and if so, how we implemented them, whether or not they really felt that climate change was an issue of concern, because we framed it as, how do you get to net zero? How do we get to net zero? So we didn't have a debate around, is climate change real? Because we've already got in law, we have to get to net zero. So now the question of how. But everybody, skeptic or otherwise, was able to have a debate about that.
And were you surprised by any of the recommendations of the Citizens Assembly?
Actually, yeah, some of them. I mean, I think some of them were as we might have expected. So there was a really strong emphasis on education and information, which generally people think that we should know more about this. And I think they felt privileged through their exposure to so much information that they wanted that to be more widely available. And they felt that government should lead. And so that, I think, is the sort of thing that we have seen previously in interviews and surveys as well. But I think some of the surprising things were around the support for some pretty ambitious measures, actually. And for me, because the bit that I was particularly leading on was the bit around food and farming and consumption. And I was quite surprised how much support there was for reducing meat and dairy consumption, actually, from the outset. And although there was little support for just, you know, banning red meat consumption and dairy consumption, there was support for between 20 to 40% reduction in consumption, which is more than we've seen when we've done surveys in the past and so on. It was more there was more support for it than we've seen previously, although our subsequent surveys actually do show there's growing support for that amongst the wider public. So I think actually attitudes generally are changing in this direction, but it was still quite interesting to see that that measure supported. And I think things like, you know, a frequent flyer levy were supported, and there'd been mixed evidence before about how well supported that is, but that had very strong support. So I think there was some, I think maybe for me, the thing that was surprising was just how engaged people were in what was really quite technical and a lot of information. And they came out with some really nuanced discussion and conditions under which a lot of these measures should be implemented. So, you know, we need to think about people on low incomes, how would this work for them, etc. So as well as generally supporting a lot of ambitious actions, they had given quite a lot of thought to how it would be rolled out in a fair and effective way.
Yeah, I'm quite jealous of the people who got to take part. It sounds like a really interesting experience. I'd like to talk a bit about your work with AR6. You're a lead author for Working Group 2 of the 6th Assessment Report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So could you summarise what AR6 is, if people haven't heard of it, and what Working Group 2 does?
AR6 is the 6th Assessment Report. There have been 5 previous syntheses of the evidence around climate change, and we're working on the 6th one at the moment, which is due to come out at the end of this year, I think. And I'm in Working Group 2, which means I'm looking at the impacts of climate change and how we adapt to those. Working Group 1 is about the sort of fundamental science of climate change, and Working Group 3 is about how we mitigate emissions, so how we reduce emissions. So I'm in the bit that's on impacts and adaptation. I'm working on the chapter that's looking at Europe in particular, and I have focused on, well, various bits of evidence, but particularly around the sort of mental health side of things and kind of how we implement policies and make decisions in this area. So so it's been a really interesting process. I couldn't have estimated quite how much work was involved in being an IPCC author. You know, there's quite a bit of kudos, I guess, associated with it. So I was very excited and flattered to be invited to join. But then you realise it's really hard work, and it's kind of, you don't get obviously any money or anything for doing it, and you just have to fit it around all your other jobs and responsibilities. And it's quite a lot of work, and you really have to pay attention to the details. So it's you're trying to come up with basically not just a sort of summary of the evidence, but also it trying to provide some sort of synthesis that then can be used by policymakers. So actually to sort of really critically bring it together in a way that sort of brings out, well, what are the implications of all of this? So it is, it is a lot of work.
How did you become a lead author?
I actually was approached just after this report process started, because somebody in the Europe chapter had dropped out. So I was approached as a replacement author. I had applied previously to be part of it because you can just sort of put your name forward. And what they do is they look at gender, discipline and country of origin, I think, to make decisions that ensure that they've got a really good spread of people from different countries, genders and disciplines across the chapters. So I hadn't made the grade for one of those reasons before, but then was asked as to be a replacement for somebody on the Europe chapter. And so through sort of colleagues I knew that were working in the space, they said that they had a gap in their expertise around the kind of more social science, because quite a lot of the people on the chapter are natural scientists, so they needed a social scientist, so they invited me.
As you say, it's a synthesis of current research up until that point. Are there, in the part that you're working on, any particular areas of disagreement that you had to, as you say, like critically assess and put together a synthesis?
So we're not actually allowed to talk about like specific things that we've found, actually. They make us sign lots of things to say that we won't talk about it. But certainly I would say there is a lot of consensus, I guess, on what the main impacts are. Has there been disagreement? There is some disagreement about, is this a bigger risk than this? You know, to what extent should we emphasize this? And because sometimes the evidence itself doesn't necessarily arbitrate and say, you know, this is going to affect more people or something. It may be more of a value judgment to some extent about which sorts of things that we emphasize, which I think is why it's important that we do have a really diverse author mix, that we're able to kind of bring our perspectives, disciplinary but also cultural, etc. And we have Indigenous knowledge represented, as well as kind of more sort of scientific forms of knowledge. So I think actually bringing all that together means that whenever there is something that you might say is a bit more of a value judgment or a kind of, you know, an expert assessment, that is something which is taken collectively as a group. So yeah, sometimes there is that kind of discussion and disagreement, but I would say I'm struck by the fact there is quite a lot of consensus in general.
And so looking into the future, you've mentioned a few behaviours that would improve our relationship with the environment. I'm wondering if you were envisaging a community in the UK in a net zero 2050 scenario, how might our lives be different?
Yeah, we're absolutely thinking about that at the moment. And I suppose when I have two young children, actually, so occasionally I do think about this in a more kind of immediate sense, like what sort of world are my kids going to grow up in? I mean, I really hope that a lot of the technologies that are being developed will help us get to net zero. And so we will have, you know, we will have very little reliance, if any, on fossil fuels. Hopefully that will be kind of more or less phased out. We will have, so a lot of renewables, we will have, you know, electric vehicles, heat pumps, etc., all the sorts of technologies that we need within society kind of fully rolled out. But I think maybe what's more interesting is how our behaviours and our institutions will have hopefully been transformed as well. I'd love to think that we might live in a slightly more equal society, because I think part of the problem is that obviously it's the richer people that emit more carbon, and yet they're also able to adapt better to climate change, and the poor who haven't emitted so much are the ones who are less able to. So it's a deeply unequal problem that we have, and it's going to exacerbate inequalities in the same way, incidentally, that pandemics are going to. So there are lots of reasons to think that the more we're affected by these sorts of risks, these sorts of big global risks, actually the worse are going to get worse off. So I really hope there's some way in which we can have a just transition within climate change to actually factor in those inequalities that we're seeing and actually address those. And that I hope that our well-being is better, because actually thinking about some of the things we need to do to reduce carbon, as I've mentioned, they can improve our health, having active travel, having more plant-based diets, and also I think sort of interacting more with local communities, perhaps, because I think there's a lot that we need to do in terms of sort of circular economy, making products that last longer, and sort of renting things and borrowing things more. And that might mean that we actually have maybe stronger communities, because we're sharing things, we're getting things repaired locally, and, you know, yeah, doing things more with our neighbours and so on. So I think that's quite a positive vision for me, and I think for quite a lot of people. So if I'm being optimistic, I think I'd like to think that 2050 will be a place where we're happier and healthier, maybe more equal, and yeah, have a more sustainable low carbon society. So yeah, mostly I try to think on the positive side.
When you're thinking about the future and trying to predict behaviour change at the population level, how easy is it to predict that? And what are the biggest uncertainties?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to predict behaviour, even at a population level, let alone obviously at an individual level, you sort of can't really do it. But we do have sort of precedents. So we have some idea about how en masse people would tend to act in relation to certain things. And so, you know, so just take the pandemic, for example, we know that in general, in these sorts of emergency type situations, people tend to broadly comply with measures to sort of protect themselves and protect society. We know that if policies are implemented in a way that is equitable and fair, so we're thinking about, you know, the rich, for example, paying more and giving, you know, protection to poorer people, in general, those things will be more accepted. And so people will comply with those sorts of measures. So we can sort of look at, well, you know, certain measures and think, well, that probably wouldn't be very popular. We'd have some sort of, you know, outcry there and that wouldn't work. So it's very difficult to know for sure how a certain thing, what effect a certain thing will have. But broadly speaking, we can make some predictions like this should work better than this. And move people in the right sort of direction. But it's an incredibly complex thing to do. So we're always sort of trying to refine our understanding. And climate change is maybe an issue like no other that we've ever had before. So there aren't really very strong precedents to think, well, it worked over here, so it should work here. We are a little bit in the dark and trying to use analogies like this is a similar sort of issue, so we might see something similar here. So that makes it a bit more complex too.
So we're almost at the end of the podcast now. I just have a couple more questions for you. The first one is, if a listener is interested in pursuing a career in environmental psychology, what advice would you have for them?
I would say there are lots of actually different career paths open to you if you're interested in this area in general. I mean, obviously there's the academic one, which I work in. So you could maybe do a master's in something related to this. You can do environmental psychology master's or applied psychology master's, and then potentially a PhD. But actually, if you wanted to maybe work for a city council or central government, or a think tank, or even industry, those are still those are careers that would use these sorts of skills where you're interested in, say, communicating environmental issues or trying to get people to change their behaviour and maybe buy green products, for example. And so, yeah, I would just say have a look at the career options open to you. There are many. You know, potentially you might need to do a master's or something to move into that area. But actually, just have a look at what sort of things that they require for those sorts of professions. But it's, yeah, very diverse.
And if listeners take away one thing from this episode of IB Green Minds, what would you want it to be?
I would say try to focus on the positives of taking action on climate change. It's good for you, it's good for other people, it's good for the planet, and talk about those positives to other people. So try not to feel like it's weird to talk about climate change. I think we have to break the climate silence, and actually just say, you know, oh, so I've discovered that this is a thing that I can do to tackle climate change, or, you know, what do you think we should do about this particular issue, and how can we make improvements? And so the more we talk about it, the more we make it normal to take action on climate change, the more we can just shift the culture to actually just making climate change attractive, normal, and encouraging people to be part of this transition to net zero.
That's a very positive note to end on. And that's all from us now. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been really interesting to talk to you and to learn more about environmental psychology.
Thank you very much.